Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. November 18th, 2003, Massachusetts made history.
Massachusetts' highest court ruled yesterday gay couples have the right to marry under the state's constitution.
Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health made the Commonwealth the first in the country to establish marriage equality. Some, like former state representative Byron Rushing, celebrated.
The best advocacy for marriage is marriage.
Others fought it, even trying to change the state's constitution. Here's then Governor Mitt Romney.
Well, I agree with 3,000 years of recorded human history, which frankly is in contravention of what the majority of the Supreme Judicial Court said.
Still, in May 2004, same-sex couples throughout Massachusetts celebrated.
Hi, Mike.
Take you, Ed.
Take you, Ed.
The joy of my heart and soul.
And in 2015, the nation followed.
The Supreme Court has affirmed same-sex marriage is the law of the land.
Sound there from MSNBC, Democracy Now!, GLAAD, and CBS. And we're going to spend the show today reflecting on 20 years of the Goodridge case, even as the American Civil Liberties Union says that it's currently tracking more than 500 anti-LGBTQ bills in states across the country. Now, first up, Hillary Goodridge, who, along with Julie Goodridge, joined a half dozen other couples in suing the state for the right to marry. We spoke with Hillary earlier this week, and I asked how she and Julie became the Goodridges and how their name became synonymous with the now famous case.
The name Goodridge was actually my maternal grandmother's maiden name. And Julie's name was Julie Wendrick. I was Hillary Smith. And before Annie was going to be born, we didn't want to hyphenate
Annie,
our names,
your daughter, for, just for listeners.
Yes, who was born in 1995. And we didn't want to hyphenate our names. And we wanted to have the same name because we recognized how much we were going to go through already saying, I'm Annie's mother, I'm Annie's other mother, and all of that. So we thought, let's change our names. And we went looking through our family trees to see what names were there. Julie really liked Goodridge because it had the word good in it, which was great. And I was, of course, happy to have my grandmother be a part of this. So that's where Goodridge came from. And, you know, we were incredibly privileged to be able to be plaintiffs at all. There were so many people who couldn't be out at work or whose employers wouldn't encourage this. I'm so lucky. I still work for the Unitarian Universalist Association, and they were more than thrilled to give me time off to work on the case and to support us right to the point of having our wedding in their beautiful building. So we had heard that we had had an incident when Annie was born. Julie gave birth to her by planned cesarean. Annie had to be in the neonatal intensive care right after being born because there was trouble. And I was trying to rush between, you know, the postpartum room and the NIC unit. And we were at a great hospital in Boston with terrific doctors. And at one point, they wouldn't let me in to see Julie because I wasn't immediate family. And they wouldn't let me in to see Annie, though I said I'm her mother, because they said her mother is recovering from surgery.
So, and no, yeah. Keep going. Go.
So we, of course, did not think, oh, we have to sue for marriage equality at that moment. But that was just one of so many experiences I think so many LGBTQ couples go through. You know, I was coming of age during AIDS and had sadly many friends who passed away and who left a partner who was not beloved by their family, bereft, sometimes financially absolutely destroyed because they didn't have, you know, the benefits of marriage at that time. So we had heard this might happen, and we went and had a conversation with Mary Bonato, and who was the attorney
the lawyer
at GLAAD.
Yeah.
Yes. And then we went down to City Hall with blood tests and a marriage license, and I mean, to get a marriage license, blood tests and our fee, and tried to get a marriage license. Julie thought we'd get one, and I thought we'd be arrested. Neither happened, but we were told we weren't allowed. And we worked our way up the supervisory chain and told we weren't allowed, and went back and wrote it up for the lawyers. And
this was 2001, is that right?
This was actually, it started in 1999 and early 2001. And then I remember one night I was giving Annie a bath and the phone rang. We still used phones in the house at that time. And Julie shouted into the bathroom, "It's Mary Bonato. She wants to know if we want to be lead plaintiffs." And I shouted back, covered in soap suds, "What does that mean?" And Julie said, "I don't know. We get our name on it or something." He said, "Sure." That was the glamorous way that that happened.
So that is knowing what we know now. I mean, yeah, you're covered exactly. In baby soap suds, right? You say, mm-hmm. Sure. And mm-hmm. it's well documented. You've been very public about the fact that when your marriage ended, part of the reason that it ended was the strain and the scrutiny after success with the case mm-hmm. that the two of you, your whole family, went through. And you know, marriage is hard. Great marriages are hard mm-hmm. under the best of circumstances. It is too trite to ask you whether it was worth it, right? That I,
you know, it was. There was a lot we went through. There was a lot of really scary moments for all the plaintiffs involved. And it was exhausting, and it was totally worth it.
Do you mind sharing a scary moment?
Oh, there was a flyer that was sent around Boston through the mail, also to many parents at the school Annie was in at the time, that talked about, it looked like it was celebratory on the front, and then you turn it over, and there's pictures of Julie and I with confetti around us. And it says, "The Goodridges aren't normal women. The Goodridges want to make," and then they describe a sex act, "legal between them." And, you know, it was disgusting. And it went everywhere. We had a number of friends who sent it to us that they had gotten it in the mail, and their kids saw it because they went, "Oh, look, there's Hillary and Julie." So, you know, there were things like that. We all got threatening phone calls, really ugly letters. And we also had incredible moments of grace from places you would not expect at all. My father, who of course loved me, but really rock rib Republican, lives in New York. And he always referred to it as Victory Tuesday, the day that they decided the case. He was so proud. He was also an estate attorney, so he understood the issues involved. But he also got all his friends on board, which was remarkable.
You two were the first to get married.
We were among the first. I'm not sure how the timing went, but we all got married very close to the same time on that day in May, yeah.
Was there any momentous left to feel by the time you'd had your name associated? Yeah, go.
Yeah, it was hugely cathartic. Is that what you're saying? It was hugely cathartic. It was exhausting because we actually didn't know that we were going to be able to go ahead with the weddings up until like the Friday before we had to, I think it was Souter on the Supreme Court had to say yes. And or they can't be stopped. And so it was a very hastily planned wedding, and it was, needless to say, a little chaotic. But, you know, when we were married by the president of the UUA, who at the time, the Reverend Bill Sinkford, and when he said, "By the power vested in me," I still lose it when I hear that. Mm-hmm. It was so remarkable. And then, you know, years ago, I had a couple of summers where I was a bridesmaid a lot. A lot of women go through this, and went to a lot of my friends' weddings. Mm-hmm. And I had been involved with my partner at the time for as long as the people getting married. And this was in the 80s. And And it kind of pissed me off. So I started doing this little guerrilla thing of catching the bouquet at every wedding I went to. And I kind of became the Ron Gronkowski of bridesmaids. You know, I would really leap. I'd kick people and leap into the air to grab them. And I kept all of the bouquets in the trunk of my car, which was a little bizarre. And, you know, everybody thought this was hysterical. Ha ha, the lesbian's going to get married. So it was really lovely right after we were married to throw our wedding bouquet into the arms of Mary Bonanno.
I want to get a little more sobering now, right? That's the joy. So yes. This is a little sound. Then President George Bush, George W. Bush, February mm-hmm. of 2004, a few mm-hmm. months after Goodridge, the decision comes down.
After more than two centuries of American jurisprudence and millennia of human experience, a few judges and local authorities are presuming to change the most fundamental institution of civilization. If we are to prevent the meaning of marriage from being changed forever, our nation must enact a constitutional amendment to protect marriage in America.
So a lot happens after that, right? So you have the Defense of Marriage Act. Yeah, well, okay, mm-hmm. just react there. Go ahead.
We were watching at home and could not believe this. And, you know, this giant snowball had sort of started to happen. You know, Mitt Romney was yelling that the whole thing is a blow against the family. Like, we're not a family.
He was the governor then of Massachusetts.
Yes, he was our governor who we had tried to meet with, and he was remarkably ignorant about our case. People were in the legislature were yelling that we're not going to have Mother's Day, Father's Day, and people are going to try to elope with their emus or something. I mean, it was insane. And when George Bush did this, clearly for political, you know, cynical political reasons and to galvanize constitutional amendments, state-based, around the country, it was stunning. And it really unleashed a lot of hatred, a lot of vitriol. And, you know, here in Massachusetts, it was brutal in many ways. I remember seeing busloads of adults with children carrying placards saying marriage is between a man and a woman. And I think, God, you don't involve children in this. You know, we were always protecting Annie from the cameras. Having our humanity questioned and belittled in public over and over was horrible. And it continues today. Only now they are beating up on the even more vulnerable members of our community.
And who do you mean by that?
Primarily trans kids, immigrants, people of color, poor people.
Here's the question that I want to ask you now then. And we're with Hillary Goodridge of the last name Goodridge from the case that legalized marriage equality in Massachusetts. It's an arguably set off a chain reaction that a little more than a decade later led to that right across the country. Today, I'm thinking about Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, the case that overturned Roe versus Wade in the court last year. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas suggested the court should reconsider similar right to privacy cases, including Obergefell, which is the decision to legalize marriage in 2015 across the country. This is a court that has taken away a right that it granted before. You have talked about the ways in which today isn't different than the days in which you were fighting for your right to marry Julie. Have we gained ground? Have we gained ground and lost ground? Do you feel like you could comfortably live in any state in America right now? Or is Massachusetts a special place?
I think, as with everything, it's like dancing school, two steps forward, one step back. And I think so many people found the comments that Clarence Thomas made, to say nothing of his other behavior, to be so abhorrent. But yes, he is a powerful person. I think when you look at the election results from last week, and you look at the fact that, you know, Andy Beshear one in Kentucky, even though
re-election is a Democrat in Kentucky. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, no.
For governor.
Even though Republicans spent about $2 million trying to make a wedge issue around trans kids there. You know, Virginia elected their first openly transgender state senator. Mississippi has their first out state senator. I think that, yes, we could get really depressed and really upset and really terrified and should be on alert and have to keep fighting. But, you know, there's incredible news that has come through. The other day, or a little while ago, I did a talk at Brookline High, and I asked the audience, primarily students, how many people here remember a time when a man couldn't marry a man or a woman couldn't marry a woman? The only people who raised their hand were faculty. So, you know, dismantling all those marriages, to say nothing of how insane that idea is, it's an administrative nightmare. I have a wonderful new boss at the UUA, the Reverend Sophia Betancourt, and she said recently, hope is a spiritual discipline, not a mood. And it made me think, like all disciplines, it means we have to keep practicing.
Hillary Goodridge of Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health spoke with us earlier this week. And now coming up, former Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, who wrote the opinion for marriage equality. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are spending the hour today looking at the legacy of Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health. It's the ruling that brought marriage equality to Massachusetts. We were the first state in the nation. Margaret Marshall was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court for Goodridge and is still known for the opinion she wrote. She joins us on the line now. Chief Justice, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
Does it feel like 20 years?
Yes and no. It feels in some ways as if it were yesterday, and in many ways as if it were a century ago.
What part feels like yesterday?
Oh, there are moments that I can remember. The waiting to see what the public reaction would be, as one does in so many cases. And even before that, watching in the Supreme Judicial Court after the oral arguments had been completed, and Mary Bonato and Judy Yogman for the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and their clients and others all streamed out of the Supreme Judicial Court courtroom, and then realizing that there were still more cases to be heard that same morning, and the people left in the courtroom, for them, those cases were just as important. So they are both visual and emotional memories. And then, of course, so much has changed in the United States since that time, so much.
Is that the part that feels like a century ago?
Yes, it is. So many people ask me, are you surprised at how quickly it moved? That is to say, the time between 2003 of the Goodridge decision and 2015 of the United States Supreme Court reaching the same decision for our entire nation. And I like to remind people that even in 2003, the first claim for marriage equality, which was filed in court, had been summarily dismissed by the United States Supreme Court. So for the people who were united in their love before 2003, some of whom had been waiting for at least 50 years. So it depends on one's perspective. It moves quickly or it moves slowly. And somehow those two come in and out of focus almost at the same time.
We're speaking with Margaret Marshall, who is a former Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and wrote the ruling on Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health that enshrined marriage equality in the state of Massachusetts. Over the years, you've said that at the time of the ruling, you didn't necessarily, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way I've understood it is sort of grasp the extent to which you had disrupted, and that came over time. Is that right?
That is correct. If one sits as a Supreme Court justice on a state court, one is accustomed to other states following or not following, in the case of same-sex marriage, for example, of marriage, not civil unions, we were the next cases, I think, that were decided by state Supreme Courts were in New York, which said no in a split opinion, no same-sex marriage in New York, followed by New Jersey, no to same-sex marriage, and then Iowa, where five justices, very courageous justices in that state, declared that in Iowa, its constitution did permit same-sex marriage. And that one becomes accustomed to that, and sometimes a ruling takes root and sort of spreads across the country, and other times it doesn't. If one is on the United States Supreme Court, of course, every decision has national impact. I think what was surprising to me was how quickly and how powerfully this decision reached not only across the entire United States, but internationally. I recall, you know, one of the leading British publications having a whole story on it in South Africa and Australia, all over the place. And that is unusual for a state Supreme Court. I can't think of another example where that happened, at least not during my tenure on the court.
We should note that you were raised in South Africa and, in fact, an activist as a young person against apartheid. What did it feel like to have this ruling resonate all the way back in your home country?
I think it didn't have quite the depth of meaning as it did to have the United States president targeting President Bush. A few judges, a few judges have decided to upset, centuries, of how societies have organized themselves. I mean, that was to me far more surprising. I grew up in a very tiny village in South Africa, and I think if you had spoken to the nuns who first started educating me at the age of four, they would have been quite surprised to find that the president of the United States was pointing a finger at me and as some judge who's upset the whole course of human history.
Of course, you did, A, and B, in the wake of that ruling, it did also galvanize fierce opposition, attempts to amend the Constitution in Massachusetts. We actually played that sound from George W. Bush earlier in the show today. Before Obergefell in 2015 came the Defense of Marriage Act in the United States. There are even political analysts who say your ruling was part of the reason George W. Bush had another term. Does that matter to a Chief Justice of a Supreme Judicial Court? Should it matter what the political implications of a ruling are? You have said before that you recognize there are political implications of a ruling. Does it matter? Should it?
In our constitutional system, I don't think it should matter. One doesn't look over one shoulder to, hold up your finger to see which way the wind is blowing. After the decision came out, some Democratic Party friends said, why didn't you hold the decision until after the presidential election of that year? If one stops to think about that, that is a terrible question. This was not a Democratic Party or Republican Party issue. This was a matter of the Massachusetts Constitution, which is a great constitution and starts with the words, all people are born free and equal. What the justices of the Supreme Judicial Court were considering was the language of the Constitution and the claims that the Commonwealth made as to why same-sex marriage should not be permitted. And I think it is worth reminding us what those claims were. The Commonwealth essentially had three arguments, which we identified in my opinion. One, that marriage between a man and a woman provides, and I'm quoting, a favorable setting for procreation, unquote. Well, that one can obtain a marriage license in Massachusetts whether or not you engage in procreation or can in fact procreate. I mean, there's no linkage between obtaining a civil license for marriage. The Commonwealth argued second that it ensure the, quote, optimal setting for child rearing. Before us, we had considerable evidence that a marriage between a man and a woman wasn't the only optimal setting. And of course, we in Massachusetts had already permitted same-sex couples who were not married to adopt children. And there are plenty of situations where children are reared very well and creatively by a single parent. And the last claim was that marriage between a man and a woman was required to preserve scarce state and private financial resources. And one of the claims there the Commonwealth was making was that somehow gay couples, I don't know why, would be more independent financially. I mean, if one stops to think about those and thinks about the nature of our families in the 21st century, none of those really bear any kind of scrutiny. And what one does as a judge is look at what the claims are. One also looks very carefully at what relief is being sought. What made Goodrich different was that there had been cases, for example, in Vermont, where the claim was for civil unions. And although the Vermont legislature provided for civil unions with very courageous legislators in that sense, it actually didn't work very well. It was difficult in all kinds of settings, school settings, hospital settings, estate settings, federal tax laws. Civil unions didn't work. And so the plaintiffs in Goodrich, and it is the plaintiffs, I believe, who were the most courageous, they had the most to lose, the seven couples who decided to take the risk of asking a court to allow them to marry. They were very clear that they wanted marriage, not civil unions. And so I think there was a clarity in the case that was brought in the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts. And one looks only at those claims. One does not look to see what one newspaper, one television, one radio station, another radio station are saying. That's irrelevant to a judge.
So this radio station, Radio Boston, is speaking with Margaret Marshall, who's the former Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. One of the things that is striking to me 20 years later is that your ruling is used in weddings, in wedding ceremonies. I'm going to play a little bit of you reading from your opinion. This is on WBUR and NPR's Here and Now back in 2013.
Civil marriage is at once a deeply personal commitment to another human being and a highly public celebration of the ideals of mutuality, companionship, intimacy, fidelity, and family. Because it fulfills yearnings for security, safe haven, and connection that express our common humanity, civil marriage is an esteemed institution, and the decision whether and whom to marry is among life's momentous acts of self-definition.
I know you weren't writing for weddings. Who were you writing for?
In all of my decisions, not just this one, I wrote primarily for the plaintiffs to understand why we had ruled in one way or another. That was terribly important. I wrote so the judges in our trial courts and appellate courts would know how we were articulating the law and for what purpose. We wrote so that the public could understand the basis of our rulings. We tried to, at least I tried to, eliminate as much legalese as we possibly could. I learned first that someone had quoted from Goodrich, I think I'm correct, when a heterosexual couple marrying in Virginia used some of the words from Goodrich. I learned about that because friends of mine in Boston happened to be at that wedding and they sent me the wedding program. And I think I was quite startled. I didn't know which part of the which part of the opinion had been read. I think what happened in the immediate aftermath was that heterosexual couples who were marrying in states where same-sex, same-gender marriage was not at that time permitted, so this is before Obergefell, I think they felt they wanted to indicate to their same-sex friends who might have been in lengthy relationships that they recognized that there was something important about this institution, the civil institution, in which some of their friends could not participate.
I want to, for our last question and our last little bit of time here, Chief Justice Marshall, ask you, you have said in other interviews that you feel the constitutional right in Massachusetts for marriage equality is safe. Today, 2023, is it safe in the United States?
Well, we know, for example, that Justice Thomas wrote a concurring opinion in the Dobbs, the abortion case. I think what we are already seeing, even at the highest national level in the United States Supreme Court and in many of the federal and state cases where there are so many attacks on this institution, what we see is a nibbling around at the edges. I think it is very problematic to take away so fundamental a right that has been so clearly articulated as a fundamental right into racial marriages, for example, in the Great Loving case, preceded by a California case. California state case has recognized interracial marriages first. It's so difficult for me to think that this would be taken away at a national level. I don't see that in Massachusetts because often state constitutions provide greater rights and protections under a state constitution than the federal court recognizes under our federal constitution. That's one of the most difficult concepts for even us in the United States to understand, let alone people from other countries. But we do have 50 states and the territories who have their own independent constitutions and then the United States Constitution overall. Under the Massachusetts Constitution, we cannot give the citizens and residents of Massachusetts fewer rights, but we can give you more. For now, I think it is fully protected in Massachusetts, fully protected.
Margaret Marshall, former Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Boston, where we are spending the hour looking at 20 years since the Supreme Judicial Court decision in Massachusetts that enshrined marriage equality as part of the state constitution. I'm Tiziana Deering. Joining us now, we reflect together with Arlene Isaacson and Gary Daffin, who were both co-chairs of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus during that time, and Alejandra St. Guillen, who in 2019 ran for Boston City Council as an openly gay woman, married in 2011 here in the state. Yes.
Yep.
So Alejandra is here in the studio with Arlene. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And Gary, you're on the line from some family time for Thanksgiving, yes?
Yep, down in Alabama.
Happy Thanksgiving. So, listen, I want to start with your reactions. We've heard from Hillary Goodridge, one of the lean plaintiffs. We've heard from former Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Margaret Marshall just now. Arlene, I've read so many of your reflections from that time. Let me just start with what's most on your mind right this minute.
Well, how it was the best of times and the worst of times. And the day of the decision was a point of absolute exhilaration. And yet when we were celebrating that night at the Colonnade Hotel, I was standing in the back of the room with just a few friends, and I was crying. And I was crying, not tears of joy, though I was thrilled by the decision, but I was crying from fear, because most of the people in the room didn't realize that we were about to head into a buzzsaw legislatively. Mm-hmm. Most thought it was pretty much the end. The decision was in our favor, so all was good. But the SJC decision was part one. It was a very civilized and thoughtful and controlled conversation. But we were about to go into the legislature, where I knew that we had nowhere near enough votes to keep the legislature from repealing our right to marry, and knowing it would be a vicious fight, knowing that there was a very good chance we wouldn't be able to win, and indeed it took us many, many, many years. And then selfishly, I confess, I was selfishly mourning the fact that I had two little kids at the time, and I knew that this battle was going to be a huge time suck and was going to take me away from them at the very young ages when you want to be around your kids. So I was sort of pre-mourning, if you will, the fact that this was going to have probably devastating consequences for my family. I naively thought it would be only for 2 years, and it ended up being for like 4 or 5. but the battle for marriage was really 10 years, from 1998 to 2007.
Gary Daffin. Gary, do I still have you?
Oh, sorry, I was on mute.
That's all right.
Yeah, I remember similarly. I think the only reason we had a chance to even come close to winning was because for the previous 10, 15 years, we had been working since we passed the gay rights law to build a coalition of supportive legislators. And I think Arlene had played a huge part of that. But I do also remember that some of the people in the community had a false sense of security, as Arlene says, and people were willing to let us go and be on a ballot initiative. People were trying to initiate a ballot initiative to repeal or prevent us from having same-sex marriage. And there were some in the community who thought, oh, we'll win. And I think people didn't realize that at that point, our support for same-sex marriage was under 50%, even in Massachusetts, even though it's much higher now. We're about 70% across the country. But we were nowhere near enjoying the support that we see now. And I think a lot of people who weren't around then don't remember that the country, people in general, did not support same-sex marriage at all. And it was a big fight from the very beginning to where we are now.
Alejandra, in preparing for this, yeah, it really struck me that the Supreme Court ruling really actually only 8 years ago. That's
right.
Not that long
right.
ago.
Right.
Part of the reason I wanted you to be here is you're sort of next gen.
Yeah.
Right? So pick it up.
Yeah. No. First of all, I'm so emotional right now, more emotional than I thought I'd be listening to the two previous speakers and Arlene and Gary, and just, thank you so much. I was one of those people who was just celebrating. Yay, we're here. It's great. I was in my mid-20s, nowhere near any kind of marriage, but I wanted the right to be able to do it. But you're right. I mean, so many of us in our 20s or earlier, at that time, didn't realize the fight that was ahead, and just ironically so, it was in 2007 that I was actually working at the State House for Diane Wilkerson when the CONCON passed, and I understood much better than I did those years earlier.
Wait, when what passed?
The Constitutional
when
Convention.
We defeated the anti-marriage equality amendment.
Yeah. Right, a lot of people don't know
Sorry.
That. Sorry. No, go.
Yeah, so it's just, it's so emotional now as a woman in her 40s with a young son who's been married for 12 years thus far. It's just I have to say thank you to all of the guests too. It's just in this much more emotional than I thought I would be at this moment.
So Arlene, Gary, did you know? So Arlene, you said legislative buzzsaw, and man, is that going to stick with me, right? So could you have known, and did you know, staring down the other end of a buzzsaw table, right, with what was coming? Could you have imagined, and did you, that actually the whole country would wind up in the other direction 12 years later?
We knew that Massachusetts was viewed by the radical right as ground zero, if you will. Mm-hmm. They thought, and probably were right, if they could defeat us here, they could defeat us in any other state in the nation. And indeed, we were the first state in the nation, not only to win it in the courts under the Goodrich decision, but we were the first state to defeat it in the legislature and keep it the constitutional amendment from becoming law. And that constitutional amendment would have undone the Goodrich decision.
And that was basically a procedural defeat, was it not?
And the way we won was by using procedural maneuvers year after year after year, because we knew had there been a vote on the merits of the issue in those previous years, we'd have lost.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. We had to use parliamentary procedures and maneuvers to avoid having a vote on the main issue, because we knew at the time of the Goodrich decision, we had approximately only 25% of the legislature on our side at best. And now subsequent to that, we found a lot of legislators. I've never seen so many legislators cry in my life when voting on an issue, and I've lobbied a lot of hot-button issues. But they were crying for two reasons. Either they were crying because they were going to vote with us, and they thought it would be the end of their political careers. Yep. Or they were crying because they were going to vote against us, and in their hearts they knew it was wrong. Yep. But they were going to do it anyway because they were afraid it would be the end of their political careers. So it was an emotionally tumultuous time. The anger, the things directed at us were absolutely vicious. Buses poured in from Ohio and Tennessee, from conservative churches around the country, to come here and demand the legislature undo our right to marry.
We're speaking with Arlene Isaacson, Gary Daffin, and Alejandra St. Guillen about the 20th anniversary of the right for marriage equality in Massachusetts. Gary, when I just heard Arlene, I thought, we see buses like that now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start. Let's just start. I don't want to kill the joy, but I also want to bring us to 20 years later.
Well, I think we're in a different time, as I said before. The culture really has helped change it. I mean, you know, we've had shows early on like Will and Grace and Ellen Show. So people, the culture sort of got used to seeing queer people, and now there are gay characters in pretty much every show. So people are okay with gay and lesbian people. I think what we see now is that, you know, the G's and the L's and the B's are no longer the other, quote unquote, but the rest of the queer community, whether it's transgender folks, non-binary folks, intersex people, are the people that the right wing is using to try and turn back the clock and to try and across the country prevent those folks from having the same liberties as the rest of society. And it's really their discomfort with all of the queer community, but mm-hmm. they no longer feel that they can sort of outright say, you know, gay lesbian people are, you know, gonna burn in hell or whatever. So I think that's where we're at. And we need to make sure that people understand that all of these folks are part of the queer community, and they all should have the same rights and responsibilities that we gained as gay and lesbian people, including the right to marriage. But I think that's what we're saying. And the attacks on transgender people, on drag performers, are really nonsensical, and the arguments that they make no sense. The same way that the arguments they made against gay and lesbian marriage made no sense, and they echoed the arguments against interracial marriage. So, you know, all of us, the civil rights movement, regardless of which community, we hear the same nonsensical arguments to keep us from having the rights that everyone else has. And we're hearing those now from people who are so anti-trans and trying to take away those rights.
So I'm just going to note here, the ACLU says that it is tracking 507 anti-LGBTQ bills in the U.S. during the 2023 legislative session. About half of those involve schools and education. More than 100 involve health care. According to the ACLU, they count two in Massachusetts, both filed by Republican House member Bradley Jones of North Reading. Both of those have to do with parental rights vis-a-vis sex education in public schools and are currently in committee. Alejandra St. Guillen, I remember the moment. So I have a son who's 18, and I remember the moment HGTV was on in the family room, mm-hmm. and House Hunters was on, and there were two women hunting for a house. And my son walks into the family room, sees House Hunters, and says, sisters or wives, and walks out.
Yeah.
Right? Because it would never occur to my son not to ask that question.
Right.
And I knew we had made a change
right.
in that moment.
Right. Right.
That's a tipping point. We heard the former Chief Justice, Margaret Marshall, say, safe in Massachusetts.
Right.
Not necessarily say safe everywhere.
Right.
And one of the things that's very much on my mind is this idea of safe in one state doesn't mean freedom of movement.
Right.
And so I wonder how you're thinking about that.
Yeah. No, and I mean, and it's something that we, you know, my wife and I think about all the time. She was born and raised in Puerto Rico. We go there several times a year. And, you know, her family's from a small town, and we feel comfortable in there. But do we feel comfortable holding hands in every section of that town? No, not necessarily. If we were to move back or move back for her, move there for the first time for me. Definitely we would look to, you know, the city and so forth as a place to go. I do think that is difficult, and that movement is difficult. I do think, though, I just have to emphasize what Gary says about just the attack on our trans community, our trans communities of color. I think even within the gay and lesbian community, it took a while for us to fully embrace and say, you know, this intolerance of them is an intolerance of us. And so we didn't win everything with the decision. We won a lot. And the cultural piece, what you said, what you're talking about with your son, Will and Grace, all of that, that is a huge shift. And that does help move the needle. But what is happening now, what has been happening historically against our BIPOC, you know, trans community is something that we need to be on the front lines fighting for. So yes, do I feel like my wife and I can't move necessarily as freely in every state or every country? No, but I'm not as concerned about that as I am about the ongoing attack on our BIPOC trans community.
So then what comes next, Arlene?
Well, you know, they're both right about the cultural change. At 20 years ago in the marriage fight, people were standing outside the state house holding signs. They wouldn't do that anymore, but they'll do it against the trans community. Mm-hmm. But we are still very much in danger if we cross the borders of Massachusetts. So, for example, a very important issue for the LGBTQ community right now is parentage. Yeah. We always assumed that once we had the right to marry, that we would automatically have our kids. But in fact, the laws in Massachusetts are 40 years behind. And so LGBTQ couples have to adopt their own children, and which is both costly and time consuming. And if, God forbid, you happen to go to Disneyland before that adoption is completed and or another red state and get into a car accident, you have, you know, where your kids or your family's hurt, you have no legal rights to the child because you don't have the adoption completed. So we have work to do still in Massachusetts.
Yeah. We recently had State Senator Julian Cyr here on the show talking about a Parentage Act that he's working on.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
So, Gary Daffin, for you, what's next?
Well, I think we have to make sure that all of the community, all the LGBTQ community, understands that this fight is not over, that we can't just take for granted that everything's fine and we no longer have to pay attention and be on guard, because there are always people promoting legislation and as we talked about across the country, but also sometimes in the more progressive states as well. And we have to sort of make sure we're both fighting those in red states, but also in the blue states, you know, sort of making sure that we're cutting the grass and sort of stopping anything that's any of those negative attempts at all. And I do worry a little bit that a generation that has grown up with the privilege of having these rights doesn't know necessarily that we have to fight or mm-hmm. how to take that fight to people in a way that you can continue to move people who might not be with us onto our side of the fence. I think what I see now is a lot of people not really willing to engage and just putting up their hands and say, I don't want to talk to you and I don't want you to speak at my university if you disagree with me. And I think those are things that are not in our favor. We were always willing, Arlene and I, to go and talk to anybody, debate anybody on television, radio, because we knew we could make the argument that people would agree with us.
We'll end it there. Gary Daffin, Alejandra St. Guillen, Arlene Isaacson, thanks to all three of you for being here to celebrate and observe 20 years of Goodrich today.
Thank you.
Come back Monday and join us. Tiffany Faison will return for Friendsgiving with several local chefs. For now, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. On behalf of the whole team and all of our guests today, thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.